You ever watch this guy on television?
You all were not telling the truth, and you should not be trusted.
Congressman Matt Gaetz, thank you for what you did for your country tonight.
Be offended with the Democratic whip, not House Republicans.
Like a machine, Matt Gaetz.
Welcome to Hot Takes. This is Congressman Matt Gaetz. Let's talk about the news. And the news of the day is surrender. In some of America's major cities, in the city of Minneapolis, the police department is going to be not just defunded, not reformed, not changed, but dismantled by their city council. And one of the city council members from Minneapolis was on CNN with Allison Camerata, and just a remarkable exchange. Take a listen.
Do you understand that the word dismantle or police free also makes some people nervous? For instance, what if in the middle of the night my home is broken into? Who do I call?
Yes, I mean, I hear that loud and clear from a lot of my neighbors, and I know, and myself too, and I know that that comes from a place of privilege, because for those of us for whom the system is working, I think we need to step back and imagine what it would feel like to already live in that reality where calling the police may mean more harm is done.
Sometimes the call doesn't come from a place of privilege. It comes from a place of fear, concern for your family. You know, I mean, when someone calls 911 because there's an intruder in their home and they're concerned for their children, they don't want a social worker to show up. They don't want someone to show up who can counsel them through their white guilt. They want someone who can neutralize a threat. That's what we have to have in society. And I am not expecting this trend of dismantling the police to sweep our nation. But when you see that Mayor Garcetti is taking action like this in the city of Los Angeles, when you see in Washington, D.C., Mariel Bowser not stating with conviction and courage that defund police is not part of the Black Lives Matter mantra that she has used the imprimatur of government to establish in Lafayette Square, it's a real slide. It's something that we can't tolerate. And I sure hope that in the right and proper and just thinking communities across this great country, that we stand with those who are willing to stand against the criminals. I joined Lou Dobbs to make very clear that I stood for order in our streets and protection for our citizens against the angry mob. Here's my exchange with Lou Dobbs.
As we look across the country, we see a vision from the radical left that is downright terrifying. They want to lock us in our homes, take our guns away, make the jobs that had us prosperous illegal, and then they want to defund the police while a radical mob runs down the street, lighting things on fire, throwing cinder blocks, and crashing our cars. I have no interest in that America. I want an America where we support the police, where we utilize every resource available to ensure that they're responsive to their communities, and the overwhelming number of people who wear that uniform, whether it's in our law enforcement or in our National Guard, they do it because they love America and they love Americans, and we need to stand with them and against these riots that seem to be terrorizing people in the name of a politics that is radical and leftist.
This week, the House Judiciary Committee will meet to consider legislation on the issue of police reform. Democrats unveiled that legislation yesterday. We're starting to get into our review and research of it. And I thought I'd talk about some of the key elements where I think there might be areas of agreement and where there may be some concern that the outcomes that my colleagues desire for safer communities might not be fully achieved if you create a withdrawal from police engagement in areas where that engagement is absolutely needed. But let's talk about the first major element of the Democrat police reform legislation, and it's to ban the chokehold. Now, I've not ever been in a chokehold. I can't imagine the experience would be all that pleasant, but it does beg the question, if any police are in an environment with someone that they need to neutralize who's not being compliant, what are the tools that you want at the police's disposal? We certainly don't want them to start by using lethal force, so obviously you want to begin with your non-lethal options, and certainly you don't want anything that's going to create any lasting impact. You want a temporary neutralization of someone who is resisting the verbal commands of police. So if the chokehold is not going to be one of the tools, you have to look at what other options might be available. Now, some places use arm bars. That could potentially break an arm. It also leave someone with the ability to sort of move the other side of their body, which could escalate a situation into the need for lethal force. So a lot of the research I've seen on sort of the arm bar as an approach concludes with the analysis that it can actually escalate violence, because if you're not able to fully neutralize someone into a submissive state, that then you maintain that level of conflict where you could get a firearm involved or have some other death or injury that would be a tragic outcome in an encounter that wouldn't have to reach that level. So armbar potentially bad. But I have to say, I did read a very interesting piece on a website called Police One, and we'll throw it up on our social media platforms. LVNR, lateral vascular neck restraint. So the principle here is that if the chokehold constrains the windpipe and the oxygen, and the way that it maintains the compliance of the suspect is to limit their ability to breathe, and then when one doesn't breathe, they obviously become highly compliant to be able to get air in their lungs. But this says that if you instead constrain the lateral blood vessels that are on the side of the neck, so think not right in front of the windpipe, but sort of under the ears, moving down under the jaws, that you can limit the blood flow to the brain, which can get someone similarly unable to resist, but that it doesn't limit their ability to get oxygen into the lungs, which we all know we need to live. And I read about this in Police One as an option. Someone's breaking it down. I also read about the experience using LVNR in Kansas City. The Kansas City Star also has a piece. Again, these are like 2013, 2014 that the literature is coming out. And it talks about how in Kansas City, this has reduced the complaints for excessive use of force. It has reduced the number of instances where force has resulted in corresponding litigation or other medical issues. And it seems to be a pretty positive experience there. Now, it has not been an entirely positive experience. There has also been circumstances where when you don't get that blood flow to the brain, you can have an elevated risk of stroke. And there was actually a case where two officers were involved in training and that stroke risk came to fruition. And there was actually litigation over the officer training on this restriction of the lateral blood vessels into the brain. So I think that we can really depoliticize this. I mean, we can get the best minds in the room on what types of restraints are effective in not creating an escalating situation where more violence would be necessary. But at the same time, I think that we've got to ensure that we don't allow that lethal force to become the next step in as many circumstances as possible. And so if there's a way to utilize blood vessels as opposed to airflow, if there's a way to substantially reduce, manage that stroke risk, we want to look at that too. But I think that this is a perfect place for Republicans and Democrats to come together with law enforcement and figure out, is there a smarter, better way to keep people safe, to keep law enforcement safe, and to keep all the tools on the table that law enforcement would need in terms of obtaining the compliance to not escalate police violence? Another issue being discussed by Democrats for potential legislation is a change in the legal immunity status of police officers. Now, some of this gets into some complicated matters of law, but I'm going to try to break it down. And you have to start by asking the question, well, what is the current state of play if someone feels like they're abused by a police officer and they want to utilize our courts to vindicate their constitutional rights? And the answer to that is something called a Section 1983 claim. And there you have to allege that someone has deprived you of a clearly established constitutional right under the color of state law. And if someone does that, then you have the ability to sue them in their official capacity, obtain a judgment against them, attain monetary relief, even obtain injunctive relief against that person, depending on the circumstance. And so it makes you wonder, well, why is that system not working now? Are there elements of negligence or areas where we're not doing our job to keep law enforcement trained, where we could shore up the law and make very clear that if someone is clearly violating the well-established constitutional rights of someone, that they ought to be held to account in our justice system, that in fact a court is a far better way to redress your grievance than throwing a cinder block through, you know, a Nike store and walking out with whatever goods you'd like as a form of faux political speech. So here, We use the court as a venue. We allow a Section 1983 claim. And there's one particular case that I found interesting. It was Canton v. Harris. It's a Supreme Court case that lays out the standard to bring a lawsuit for the failure to train someone. And if we can develop some clear standards for training when it comes to chokeholds, when it comes to the use of lethal force, then, you know, there might be a mechanism by which we look at the ways someone would vindicate their rights to make a failure to train claim. And as I looked at the jurisprudence today, you have to prove that the training was the lack of training, I should say, was deliberate interference in a constitutional right, and that there is some proximate cause between the failure to provide that training and the injury. For example, if someone was killed because there was not good training on how to use a weapon, you probably couldn't use the lack of training on a chokehold as the basis to bring that claim. So ensuring that there's causation between the lack of the training and the injury seems important. And so I think that under this current Section 1983 standard, under the jurisprudence that I reviewed, saying that even if there's a lack of training or awareness about correct standards, that there's a way to bring an action, you know, I am at this moment unconvinced that altering the immunities that law enforcement enjoys will give us a greater probability of getting out the bad actors. There is the concept of a national registry of people and the incidents involved in the claims that are made against them regarding police abuse. And I think there's a way for state attorneys general to have a platform, to be able to share information, to be able to find bad apples. Look, I stand with the police. I stand against these riots. I think that there is so much of the protest culture that is an overgeneralized indictment of our country and our law enforcement. I think that when there's one bad apple in a department, that doesn't indict the whole organization because of one bad person. I mean, heck, we have bad people in Congress we find all the time. We had one guy that was writing love letters to his staff. When we figured that out, you know, he left the Congress. We did not disband the entire United States Congress because one guy did something wrong. I mean, I had one colleague who propositioned to have a threesome with his secretary and a lobbyist. And again, and then used taxpayer money to go and pay off the sexual harassment claim of his staffer. We didn't dissolve the Judiciary Committee because he happened to serve on the Judiciary Committee. We found a way to reconcile an accountability for his precise actions. So, I mean, when one police officer does something in one case, I don't think that that imputes to every law enforcement officer or every person in their department. But I think it is important to ensure that we have a way to root out the bad apples. And if there's a way with some sharing of information and greater transparency about complaints while giving people due process, I think that's important. I don't think you label people without due process. I think you could actually build some good out of this and ensure that the good police officers that hate to see this conflict in our communities have the tools to clean up their own community. And I think they need to have that opportunity. And I think that in a society that still very much deals with race as an element of how we interact with each other and how we see ourselves and how we see the circumstances that we find ourselves and others in, you know, having that ability to track instances, to be able to utilize data, would seemingly be a very positive contribution that my Democrat colleagues could be making, and they could find themselves with a good deal of Republican support. The Democrats have included in their legislation also a prohibition against no-knock warrants. So if you're wondering what a no-knock warrant is, it's a circumstance where the government has gone before a judge and proven that if you give the subject of the warrant notice that the warrant is going to be executed, that could potentially lead to the destruction of evidence, the moving of evidence. That could lead to physical harm to other witnesses. It could lead to harm to law enforcement. So in some cases, a judge has to have a higher standard than a regular warrant, and they issue a no-knock warrant. And there have been cases where these no-knock warrants have tragic outcomes, where people who would not have otherwise lost their life do as a consequence of that elevated attention and that elevated anticipation regarding the entry of a premises without warning. But it does beg the question, if you didn't have no-knock warrants, what would be the consequence? Would you put more law enforcement in danger? Would you put more witnesses in danger? I mean, these things are used in like 20,000 cases each and every year. And I'm concerned that if you make a fundamental change there, you really better know what you're doing. And I would have to see a lot more evidence. Again, we only got this piece of legislation yesterday, but I would have to see a lot more evidence that there'd be a way to keep the public, others around, innocent bystanders and law enforcement safe in instances where that type of notice could create a far more dangerous environment for people. And if you get rid of no-knock warrants, and if you get rid of the qualified immunity that police enjoy, I think one of the logical outcomes we can anticipate as a society is a pullback of police. And it's something that the media and researchers have written a lot about called the Ferguson effect. So I want to talk about the Ferguson effect. There's a great piece in USA Today in January of 2017 by Amir Madhami, and it talks about 3/4 of law enforcement being more reluctant after these high-profile encounters leading to protests with police and African-American victims, 3/4 of law enforcement, and this was even before the Floyd case, saying that they are more reluctant to engage. And it cites a Pew Research study of over 8,000 law enforcement officers. And you even have people that the left has gravitated to, voices like Rahm Emanuel saying, gosh, you know, we've got to have an engaged, proactive police department. The study and the data quote Jim Comey, who was the FBI director of some fame and of some very negative consequences, saying that he had seen a pullback in police following some of these cases. And so if you look at the Ferguson case, if you look at what has happened in Baltimore, Washington, other places following some of these high-profile shootings of African Americans by law enforcement, you do see law enforcement less likely to have that proactive approach Rahm Emanuel talked about, less likely to really go forward and ensure that communities are safe from those who might be legitimately committing crimes out of fear that it could create a high-profile encounter. And, you know, the people who are hurt most by a law enforcement pullback are not the folks in the whitest parts of white suburbia. It's folks in lower income communities. It's folks in minority communities. It's folks in urban communities that suffer greatest when there's a law enforcement pullback. And so I do not believe that is our destiny. I think that if we come together and acknowledge that there are improvements we can make to policing, just like there are improvements we can make to every profession, there's an acknowledgement of how to treat people better in policing, just like we could do so in medicine or in the practice of law or accounting or constituent service in the United States Congress. We can make it all better by getting the best science, the best data. I think that's where we can have a nonpartisan exercise. But if you start to see in the House Judiciary Committee and then beyond a continuation of this defund the police, delegitimize, dismantle, surrender mentality, if we start to take the view that there are some places where law enforcement should simply throw their hands up and allow communities to deal with whatever savage element would harm the weak or the disabled or the young or the old or those who are unable to defend themselves, well, I'm not for that. And I don't think our country should be for that. And that will be a circumstance where Republicans stand on the side of law-abiding people who deserve to have the law enforced. And I think there are ways we can enforce that law better, more fairly, more effectively, and that is something that should unite all Americans. Thanks for listening. This has been Congressman Matt Gaetz. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review and a comment or a suggestion or even a criticism. I love your hot takes, and I hope you'll be back tomorrow for mine.